Welcome back to Crosstabs, the podcast about what polls really are and what they really aren't, designed for those of us who find it soothing to understand how something actually works, even when that something stresses us out. I'm your host, Farah Bostic. I'm the founder of The Difference Engine, an insight-driven strategy consultancy. This time, I'm going to do a bit of a different introduction because this episode is, in a way, the first in a three-part series about why sample sources and survey design matter so much in any kind of research design, but given the stakes, especially in public polling. As you know, I hope, I'm not a public or political pollster. I am a researcher and a strategist, and so I'm a huge fan of the work done by the Pew Research Center. I have relied on their studies for most of my career across a wide array of projects for clients in advertising, technology, news, other media, healthcare, everything. Their work on politics and policy, though, is impeccable. They are a terrific resource for me as a researcher because not only do they publish their methodologies, they research the research. And that's where the story of this episode began. Pew published an article about the rise of mixed methodology in political polling, more pollsters employing phone calls, text messages, online surveys, and traditional mail to field their surveys. As we were working on scheduling this interview, Pew published another article about bogus respondents in online opt-in polling, and this piqued my interest because while my primary expertise is qualitative research, we do a ton of mixed method research, and we rely almost entirely on online opt-in sample providers. It's also known as convenience sample. For years, it seemed like the primary concern was either people, you know, taking surveys quickly just to make a buck, or there was this kind of looming threat of bots. When this piece came out, though, it showed that the problem isn't bots, and it's not just speeding. It's a way more complicated array of bogus responding. And that kind of sent me down a rabbit hole trying to understand more about what's happening in sample. As a researcher, I will confess, this is not something I've spent a ton of time thinking about. I have partners who look after this for me, or I think I do. But in the last year or two, we've started to run into this problem, even in qualitative research. We see people making up elaborate legends, pretending to be someone and somewhere they are not, even going so far as to create essentially fake LinkedIn profiles. And we have people using ChatGPT and other generative tools to respond to open-ended questions in our screening questionnaires. It's making it just a little bit harder to feel like we can trust that the people we want to talk to are the people we are, in fact, talking to. So in this conversation with Pew's own Andrew Mercer, a senior research methodologist at the Pew Research Center, we're going to start this deep dive. In this episode and the following two episodes, you're going to learn a lot more about how and why survey fraud happens and what can be done to improve the situation. If you rely on surveys, conduct them, use self-service research platforms for your own businesses, or just are concerned about online fraudulent activity in any capacity or industry, this series of episodes will, I hope, be extremely eye-opening. As a quick reminder, Crosstabs is a free podcast with an accompanying newsletter. I started this thing because it's an election year when more people than normal are thinking about opinion research, but it really is for anyone working in politics, strategy, research, marketing, academia, anyone depending on researchers, data scientists, and strategists to help them make big decisions. The best way to support the show and this mission is to take a few quick actions. First, if you haven't already, subscribe to the show in your podcast app. Give us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts. Sign up for the free weekly newsletter at crosstabspodcast.com. And tell a friend about the show. We have a small cadre of dedicated listeners, but I'd love your help to see it grow. Okay, that's enough housekeeping. Let's get on with my conversation with Andrew Mercer of the Pew Research Center.
You know, I started out actually initially thinking polling would be interesting, you know, 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago now, actually, seeing an ad for two jobs and applying to the one that I thought I had a better shot of getting. And sort of, so I started out as like a survey programmer at a polling firm that did campaign work. And it was fascinating. I was mostly doing technical stuff and sort of running Crosstabs. And I got about as far as I thought I could go there. Went to grad school for survey methodology and actually ended up working later at a firm called Westat, which does big sort of government surveys for places like the Census Bureau and the CDC. And then, you know, found Pew through some local APOR connections. APOR is the American Association for Public Opinion Research. and just had always loved the kind of work that they do and the fast-paced nature of the study. And yeah, the rest is history.
Maybe just because last week was the APOR conference, I haven't been able to attend. So maybe you could just talk a bit about the organization and what it does. And
sure. Yeah. So APOR is the Trade Association for Survey Researchers, very broadly speaking. And that includes sort of not just pollsters like myself who do public opinion research. It also includes people like government researchers, folks at places like the Census Bureau or the CDC or the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So the people who calculate the employment rate, they're all members of APOR. And then a lot of sort of academic survey researchers and campaign people. It's really the whole population of people who do surveys on a wide, wide range of topics and styles. So the organization, you know, like any professional organization, is sort of designed to create standards for things like transparency, best practices, and, you know, sort of help move the field forward, bring people together to solve problems facing the field. I think the biggest thing that sort of impacts people day to day is it sets the ethical standards for how survey researchers are supposed to conduct and sort of report on the data that they collect.
When you think about in election years like this, where we've got a variety of types of pollsters, and this is one of the things that, you know, that I've been doing through these interviews is talking to people who maybe are more likely to do kind of internal campaign polling versus public opinion, or rather public polling, let's put it that way. So,
yeah.
You know, we talked to Paul Westcott from L2, which provides voter file information to New York Times Siena. And we talked to some folks from Benenson Strategy Group, for example. And you have those two kind of, I don't want to say obvious, but like if you're a bit more of a news junkie politics nerd, you probably are aware that there's a difference between public and internal polling.
Yeah.
But there's also kind of a broader universe of people who are fielding, or organizations rather, that are fielding political polls in an election year for a variety of reasons. And I'm curious how you kind of map that landscape. What are the broad strokes categories of actors in political polling these days?
So I think, I mean, you sort of covered, you know, a lot of it. I mean, there are sort of the people polling directly for the campaigns. And related to that, there are people polling for, you know, independent expenditures and, you know, third parties who have an interest in the campaign. And that mostly tends to be focused really exclusively on how to best target campaign resources or funding, things like that, messaging. Then you've got I guess public pollsters, you know, like us at Pew, who they all tend to have a sort of a different emphases, but, you know, generally, at least for us, it's about trying to understand, you know, what the big picture is in the election, sort of what's driving the broad trends. You know, it's not necessarily to figure out, you know, who's ahead today, but really sort of trying to understand sort of the dynamics that are at work in the population, you know, as we go through these things. And that's sort of a lot of the media organizations, I think. There's some academic pollsters, you know, who sort of are, I don't know, maybe in between the two. But that's sort of the two ends of the campaign polling spectrum. You know, there are a lot of people who sort of, not even sure how I'd categorize it, but who sort of do a lot of public polling during an election for unspecified reasons, you know, sort of just doing a lot of horse race polling and kind of putting it out. Yeah, I'm not sure how I would classify that. You know, sort of it's all public, but there's not a lot of sort of broader research about the, you know, sort of the population dynamics.
Right. I think there was a piece that I think came from you guys that was talking about, it may have been in the piece about the rise of mixed methodologies, but it did seem like there was like a sudden, you know, growth spurt in the number of pollsters out there.
Yeah.
What do you think was driving that? What enabled that to take place?
So the internet, basically. So, you know, historically, Pew and most of the other sort of public opinion pollsters, if you go back, you know, 20 years or longer, were doing telephone polls, right? You would get a random sample of telephone numbers. Originally, it was just a random sample of landline numbers. Then we'd get a random sample of landline and cell phone numbers. But so you'd call people up and you would, you know, ask them to take a survey. And that's very expensive, right? So only a few organizations that have a lot of resources could do that. And since about, I don't know, 2010-ish or so, there's been sort of the development of what we call online opt-in sampling, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, it's conducted online. It's a, so it's a web survey that somebody, there's no interviewer, they're just taking it in their browser. So that's the online part. And then the opt-in is that rather than taking sort of a random sample of the whole population, like a random sample of phone numbers or a random sample of addresses, which is what we do now at Pew, they sort of get people online from a whole variety of methods, either clicking ads or, you know, as part of a like a mobile app where you might get points in your game in exchange for taking online surveys, a whole host of ways people can sign up. But what that means is it's very, very cheap. It's a way to do very inexpensive data collection. And so when the, you know, avenues for doing that, sample providers sort of came to prominence, I think a lot more people were able to start doing polling and, you know, using these inexpensive methods and doing lots and lots and lots of polls. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of the origin of it. You know, the challenge, and this is potentially too far in the weeds, there's a lot of ways to do online polling. So and at Pew, we don't do opt-in polling. We do, right. You know, we sort of start with a random sample of addresses that we contact offline, mm-hmm. right? And then recruit them to take surveys in the future online. That's still a very expensive way to do things, but we found it gets you better data quality and produces more accurate results. But essentially, the barrier to entry pretty much disappeared around, you know, the early aughts.
Mm-hmm. I was looking back at something I wrote in 2016 that was looking at, I want to say it was PPP was the polling firm, and they were doing a lot of very, I don't even mean this pejoratively, but a lot of kind of clickbaity polling. And it was asking questions about sort of odd ideas that were bubbling up on, you know, one side or the other of the political spectrum. And as a communications and brand and market researcher, my reaction to those polls, because I think, you know, they were very controversial at the time in 2016, it was like, are you just trying to make, I don't know, I think a lot of them had to do with beliefs of Trump supporters and kind of early QAnon conspiracy ideas and things like that. But the reaction was like, is this just clickbaity, link bait kind of polling, which I think, yes, is one answer to that question. The other answer to that question is, it's an interesting way of gauging kind of, broadly speaking, message breakthrough. Like if people are responding that they agree with that thing, one thing as a communications researcher, I would assume is they've heard it before, right? That maybe that's just like a measure of, yes, I've heard that conspiracy theory. But it seems like some of those kinds of polls have subsided and that everyone's become a little bit more, I don't know if this is true, but I feel like in the public discourse, there's less of that kind of link baity sort of research. It's a little more sober. It also seems like there is a lot more attention placed on sample sources, sample sizes, margin of error, those kinds of things than maybe people were thinking about in previous election cycles. And I'm curious about like how you've seen that evolution take place. And if I'm wrong, like if it's just like the media I'm reading looks like that and there's other things going on.
Yeah, I think so. You know, certainly in, I think the media that reports on election polling specifically and the people who really follow all of this closely, you know, there are a lot of folks from the media organizations who are members of APOR themselves and are very right. sort of steeped in all of this. I mean, actually, Jenna Gesta, the president of APOR this year, the outgoing president, is CNN's pollster. And so they're mm-hmm. very plugged into the sorts of things people are thinking about. And, you know, I think the big polling errors in 2016 and 2020, you know, that really understated the support that Donald Trump was going to get, I think has led a lot of folks in that universe to focus a lot more heavily on things like data quality and transparency mm-hmm. and, you know, sort of adopting stronger standards for what they'll be willing to report on, you know. So I think there is a set of journalists out there who do pay a lot more attention to this, I think, mm-hmm. especially after kind of getting burned and twice. And, you know, the irony, of course, is that in the midterms, the polls actually did pretty well, but we don't hear as much about that. But, you know, I think there's still a lot of people, though, who follow the polls, are sort of not in the weeds like that, you know, and sort of have it could, you know, run with things that maybe they shouldn't. But yeah, I think basically there's just a much bigger focus on or and a greater understanding of the ways sort of polling can go wrong and trying to understand sort of what those are, you know, and everybody sort of knows about the margin of error, right? Hopefully. And so when a poll says it has a margin of error, you know, plus or minus 3 percentage points, you know, what a lot of people don't or historically haven't really known is that that's just the kind of random error that you would get from talking to a random sample of people, right? And it doesn't account for other things like certain kinds of, you know, Trump supporters, for example, being less willing to take surveys, right? And so, you know, we have this idea sort of in the academic survey research area called total survey error, which is that that's just one sampling is one tiny part of error. And then there's other things like non-response and there's a whole host of them I won't get into, but basically sort of understanding that there are other sources of error in polling and really trying to understand what those are and be cognizant of that when making decisions about, you know, how to interpret polling results.
Yes, this is one of the things that I've become a bit of a pedant about in talking to people where there's like, well, the poll, you know, the top line margin of error is, you know, I had someone say this to me the other day that I think it was the Journal had put out their 5 or 6 state swing state poll and the total sample size was like 4,200 people. So I think maybe it was 7 states. And so the top line margin of error was reported at like 1.5%. And
right.
It's like, okay, but then when you get into the state by state results, you're looking at a total base size of 600. And now you want to compare men versus women, people of color versus white people, Republicans versus Democrats. Like every time you slice it down to a smaller base size, the margin of error goes up. And so there's also, you know, question designs and question types have different margins of error and those sorts of things. But this is not, I think, like we're just edging into kind of popular education about the margin of error. And then, of course, you also have I think Nate Cohn at The Upshot did this piece, I think in 2016, actually, about giving 4 or 5 different pollsters the exact same data set and asking them to estimate the margin of error. And they all came back with different estimates.
Yeah, and different, you know, and different results. They all sort of analyzed the data different ways and came to sort of different conclusions. Yeah, I think that that's probably something people... It's underappreciating, I guess I would say, is that, you know, there are a whole lot of different ways of doing polling. There's a ton of decisions that you have to make about, you know, how to collect the data, how to draw your sample in the first place, you know, and then how to weight it, which is what we essentially weighting is to sort of make the sample look more like the population on, you know, some set of whatever dimensions you think are most important. There's a lot of ways you can go about that and they work differently. Mm-hmm. And so, so it's easy to see, you know, different polling results from different organizations who do things different ways. You know, one of the challenges is that people ask, well, which one is right? And it's like, well, I mean, neither of them are necessarily wrong, right? There are people are doing things differently in ways that are defensible and well thought out, you know?
Yeah.
Election polling, there will be a result at some point that people can compare to. But even there, you know, people have to come up with, you know, their sort of likely voter models to know what the electorate is going to look like, you know, and that's a whole separate exercise. But for example, if you're doing a survey of sort of all adults who they support, you know, including non-registered voters or people who aren't going to vote, that's not necessarily going to look like somebody's estimate who's trying to sort of predict the horse race. And they're sort of both fine. It's just that they have sort of different purposes, right? One is trying to predict who's going to win, and the other is trying to understand sort of what the broader public thinks about candidates and you know, all that.
That's a perfect segue into what I wanted to talk about next, because I think the first sort of version of weighting that people might be the most familiar with is drawing a distinction between all U.S. adults. You know, you'll frequently see like YouGov polls that are like all U.S. adults, not exclusively them, but they do a lot of that sort of thing. Then you'll see registered voter versions. And, you know, like New York Times Siena does that where it'll be like registered voters versus likely voters cross tabs. And so you'll have this like all U.S. adults, registered voters, likely voters. Obviously, there's
a mix of methods about determining who's a registered voter. And then there's a whole lot of approaches to figuring out who a likely voter is. And I tend to think of, I'll quickly do my fangirl routine about the Pew Research Center, because it is one of those amazing resources that people who work in market research and brand strategy and things like that, when you're training up a junior strategist, it's like, go look at Pew and see if they've got anything about this, because some group within Pew has done research about the thing we're curious about almost all of the time. But it is there to help us understand things. Like in marketing, this is the distinction I always draw. No client I represent has one day every 2 to 4 years where all of their potential customers make a decision between them and somebody else, right? Like they're kind of constantly selling. So margin of error matters in our methodology, but it's not that big of a deal because we're not really making precise predictions in that way. We're looking for directions to go in. We're looking to understand something so that we can develop messaging or customer experiences or whatever. It's quite different in polling. Some polling really seems to be about making an accurate prediction. Some polling seems to be about trying to unpack and understand how different constituencies are reacting to different candidates or issues or thinking about things. Does Pew have a position on that? Are you trying to make a prediction, or are you more in the understanding game?
No, so we are not trying to sort of predict the winner of the horse race. You know, we do ask who people support in the mm-hmm. election, but, you know, usually it's the aim here is to try to understand, what do the people who support Biden or support Trump, what do they care about, or what are their mm-hmm. motivations, or how are those groups changing, and maybe why? Right. Elections are a big, important thing, and who wins is important. We'll know that on election day.
Right.
You know, and sort of what we want to...
The one poll that really matters, yeah.
as they yeah. say, right. And sort of what we're trying to understand is not who's going to win, but just to understand the whole... you know, how everybody in the public, including non-voters, non-registered voters, what they think and what's important to them. You know, it's not just who's going to win.
Even in the kind of understanding of the complexities of modeling the actual electorate, I think about an interview I heard with Ann Seltzer several months ago now, where one of the things she talked about is for the Iowa poll, they just sort of survey everybody over 18 and don't bother modeling likely voter or not likely voter. And some of that's because it's caucuses, and some of that's because it's not that populous of a state, and some of that's because unlikely voters suddenly to become voters, or people have never voted before vote. And so the kind of modeling gets dicey. I'm curious about some of the approaches to modeling likely voter, because I feel like as I read through polling methodologies, there's a lot of different ways of doing that. And some of them strike me as that doesn't feel like necessarily a likely voter. It just feels like someone you have a higher rate of confidence are actually registered to vote, for example. but some of them are just sort of like, how are you arriving at that set of conclusions?
Yeah. So we don't actually do likely voter modeling mm-hmm. at Pew. You know, I know a little about what sort of people are doing, but it is, you know, it is different. There's a lot of different ways. I mean, some people just ask, how likely are you to vote?
Yeah.
And others are using more sort of complicated statistical models to sort of what's the probability that somebody's going to vote mm-hmm. based on, you know, their characteristics. What a lot of pollsters are doing now is using what's called national voter files, right? Mm-hmm. So this is all of the states have a list of registered voters in those states. And there are some companies, you mentioned L2 and the New York yeah. Times, Siena Poll, they do this, where they go collect all of those files from all of the states. And then they have one big database of everybody who's registered to vote. And part of that also is that there is a record of who in fact voted. You know, so that's all generally public record almost everywhere. So they mm-hmm. have individuals' vote history, and so they can, you know, build models to try to forecast what somebody's going to do based on what they've done in the past. Mm-hmm. But it's hard because the population of people who voted in 2024 will not exist, you know, until after the election. And so right now, that really is a whole trying to predict the future. I like to think of polls as sort of a snapshot of the population at a particular point in time. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of doing something that is a little bit different and actually much more difficult, in my mm-hmm. opinion.
So that, I think, maybe also dovetails into my question about this rise of mixed methods for contacting people and for conducting the surveys themselves. That candidly, when we conduct surveys, most of the time they're conducted entirely online. There's no phone interview anymore, except under very specific circumstances. But my sense is that given various sources of non-response, various difficult to reach populations, people who are more or less likely to have landlines versus cell phones, or more or less likely to have good internet connections versus not, that there's sort of a cobbling together of methods now, both to essentially recruit people into a survey and also then to conduct the survey itself. And maybe you guys published something a couple months ago about this, and I think it's extremely interesting to see this mix.
There's a ton of different methods, you know, right. A lot of it is sort of driven by a combination of cost, you know, having a human being call somebody on the phone is very expensive. So, you know, you wind up with people trying to, you know, innovate, right? One of the things people wanted to do was to use IVR, interactive voice response, which is sort of an automated telephone call, right? But that has drawbacks because regulations are such that you can only do that if somebody has consented or you're calling a landline phone, right? So you can't do that with cell phones, right? So then to balance that off, some people will combine IVR on the phone with landlines with an online sample to try to get the kinds of people who have a cell phone, right? You know, one thing we do is we have a big survey that we do every year. We call it the National Public Opinion Reference Survey, basically, which is a large, high quality, high response rate survey that we use so that we have a source of weighting benchmarks for things that the government doesn't measure, like party identification or religious identification, things like that. And what we do there is it's called a sort of push to web strategy where we mail people an invitation to take the survey online. And we try to get them to do that. And if they don't take it online, what we do is we actually mail them a paper questionnaire. And the reason we do that is there's a lot of people who just don't want to take a survey online either because they're not comfortable with it, they're distrustful of, you know, researchers potentially or you know, putting their information online. But so by sending a second mode, we get a much, much larger response rate, and we get a lot of the kinds of people who wouldn't be willing to take a survey online. And there's a whole bunch of people who are sort of using different methods to try to balance the whole cost question while also trying to get people to take surveys in a way that they're willing to. You know, I think it's very hard to get young people to answer a phone call, but you might get them to respond to a text. That's a big thing that was a big topic of conversation this year at APOR, actually, is, you know, text to web surveys where you get somebody's cell phone number and text them a link to take a survey. You can either get those phone numbers off the voter file or just a random list of phone numbers. But that's a new big way to try to conduct surveys. So we'll see. We'll see how that works out this year. Yeah,
I'll report. I'm actually getting a ton of those. I live in the New York First, and so there is a congressional race, and there is an active primary this year where there's, you know, two candidates actually vying for the Democratic side. Lalota's, you know, basically on his own. But the interesting thing is, in addition to all the flyers that we're used to getting, now I'm getting texted constantly survey links about Long Island politics and about the congressional race and that sort of thing. The interesting thing I think about with that is that one of the things I've noticed when I click through to those links is I get the impression that most of the time those surveys were still designed to be taken on a desktop. And here I am on my phone going like, oh, a matrix question. Scroll, 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 like change to see if it'll adjust if I move to portrait mode versus landscape. I'm curious if there was conversation about the kind of the experience difference. Like we're kind of creating one survey instrument, doing it as a phone call, doing it as an IVR, doing it as a desktop experience, doing it as a mobile experience. You want to be able to ask the same sets of questions to compare the answers, but then again, does it change the way we think about question design?
So it should, right? We call these mode effects, right? Where if you take a survey in one mode, say online, mode being the term of art for the way you take the survey, versus in another mode with a telephone interview or with a phone, people do sort of do things differently depending on the way they're asked a question. And some of it is things like smartphones versus tablets or smartphones versus computers and what people are able to see. So on a web survey, what's really important is how people visually process things, right? Mm-hmm. And so, for example, on a web survey, people are more likely to answer questions that are higher up on the screen, right? In terms of sort of visually, mm-hmm. they answer the first thing on a list that is a adequate answer for them, right? Which means it's going to be toward closer to the top, right? Whereas right. with an interviewer on the phone, you're more likely to pick the more recent thing that you heard, which is the thing at the bottom of the list, right? So these are the kinds of things. You know, we also know online, when you don't have an interviewer, people are more likely to admit to doing socially undesirable things, mm-hmm. right? So if you ask about illegal drug use, right, you get higher reporting of that if it's a web survey than if they're talking to a human being. And then there's just usability, right? If, you know, actually, most of the people who take our surveys now online are doing it on a smartphone. And so we have very carefully designed all of our surveys and adopted practices that optimize for that so that you don't have these, you know, grids that scroll across the screen. We don't use grids at all. They have all sorts of problems, but I get why people like them.
If I had a preloaded applause and like cheering effect, I would play it right now.
they're very compact, but they don't give you very good data. These are all things that we try to think about. You know, I mean, one interesting thing that sort of is related to a recent publication we had is party identification. And, you know, the challenge is on the phone. The way we have always asked that question is, you know, are you a Democrat, a Republican, or something else? And a lot of people will say, you know, neither of those two things, right? They're an independent. And so, but we also know most of those people actually do prefer one party or the other. And so we ask this question, do you lean toward either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party? And on the phone, it's very easy to answer that question by just saying no, right? Mm-hmm. But online, you have to present three explicit options, right?
Right.
And so the interesting thing is if you have options for Democrat, Republican, or, you know, neither, you get way, way more people choosing the neither than you would on the phone. If you leave out that neither category, you get way, way less people, you know, skipping the question and sort of refusing to pick one. And it's that these things are just very, I don't know, subtle, I guess. They're not subtle when you look at the differences, but they can lead to sort of big differences in terms of what the distribution looks like. So we did a study on party ID where we actually went and did some statistical modeling to go back and sort of look at our whole history of partisanship, adjusted to what if we had asked this question online instead of on the web, making that adjustment to sort of see how, you know, our telephone trends connect with our online trends. But yeah, there's a lot of these kinds of issues, especially as more and more research moves online.
I was looking at the Journal's swing state poll versus the New York Times swing state poll, and I think, I can't remember which one did which, but one asked the question with, you know, Democrat, lean Democrat, neither, lean Republican. But the other one just went Democrat, Republican, neither, independent, whatever, did not answer. You know, the typical thing is it's more or less a third when you ask it those ways. I mean, the third that's a little bigger than the others is often independent or none. Right. And then when you look at the version of the survey that asked it with the five options instead of three, all of a sudden the independent don't know, didn't answer is only like 10% and everybody else gets distributed. The question that I think that comes up in people's minds is how should they expect that distribution to work? And is it just that, like, you take the third in the middle and split them up a third again, and they kind of distribute across pretty evenly?
You know, the hard thing here, right, is that measuring similar but just slightly different things, right, with the question. And so there's no way it sort of should work, right? Or to the extent that there is some sort of universal true party identification thing that we're trying to get at with a question, that's going to map differently depending on how you ask it. And so, you know, I don't necessarily think that it should look one way or the other necessarily. You know, I think I would just say, you know, there are sort of advantages and disadvantages to asking the question in different ways depending on sort of what you're trying to get at. And so I think that's kind of, you know, how I would think about it is that usually Not always, but usually when people ask a question a certain way, you know, there's sort of a good reason for it. Right. Even if sometimes that's just that's the way we've always asked it in the past and we want to have some continuity.
Yeah.
And that's okay. That will give you somewhat different results, but that's fine. You know, mm-hmm. that's what you were trying to do.
So this leads me to a slightly different question, which is there are a lot of these things that I think are done because we've always asked them that way. Like the, you know, the archetypal Reddit example is going to be right track, wrong direction, and that it's not strictly speaking parallel construction and whatever. And so you have people who say right track, wrong track, or right direction, wrong direction. But, you know, there's some value in asking it consistently the same way over time because you can correlate the responses with some other set of outcomes. Are there questions, though, that feel like the profession has moved on from them, or that it is, you know, they're ripe for either getting rid of them altogether or kind of re-theorizing them and changing the way the scale is expressed or the way the options are expressed or even the way the question is articulated?
This is really hard. You know, so party identification is one of them, right? The way we have of asking it really does originate from a, you know, place where the assumption was there was going to be an interviewer on the phone, right? Mm. You know, the irony, though, is we actually have tested a variety of different ways of doing this. Other people have done it, too. And at the end of the day, on that one, there aren't just sort of huge differences in terms of adopting some sort of radical new way of asking it. We haven't found the advantages to outweigh, you know, the disadvantages, right? Mm-hmm. And there really is a value to a long trend and having that consistency that you can, you know, sort of measure over time. You know, I think when these things come up, I can't think of one offhand, but mm-hmm. I think if a question just no longer makes sense in the current context, people will probably just stop asking it. Yeah, I don't have a good example of something that sort of is prominently out there but needs an overhaul. You know, I think changing right direction, wrong track to be consistent wording is not of the that's not the magnitude of change that I think is, you know, would actually result in anything massively different.
Yeah, I think, you know, the examples I've come across so far have been more things like I was talking to David Wilson about the racial resentment index, mm-hmm. and that one feels like it's probably due for an update.
I could see that there are certain kinds of, scales and how certain things are measured. Mm-hmm. Well, one that I guess has been getting a lot of work, you know, is sort of how people ask about sex and gender, you know, and that's actually been a big focus of research, and people, you know, are trying to figure out, you know, sort of how best to measure these things.
Yeah.
And so, like, that's been a big source of work in the government, which is trying mm-hmm. to, you know, initially on sort of health surveys, but now on other surveys. We no longer just ask, are you a male or a female? There's a lot of work on sort of how to best do this in a way that is inclusive and lets people sort of accurately describe themselves in the data, mm-hmm. while also not confusing people who don't get it or who aren't, you know, who don't know what the terms are and don't think about, you know, the difference between sex or gender. There's a lot of nuance, but it doesn't really, you know, apply to them. So they need to be able to sort of answer the question accurately as well without getting screwed up. So it's a challenge, but yeah, that's the sort of thing I think that people are working on. And that's less about sort of mode, but just kind of the changing of the times and the way people think about themselves, you know, in demographic terms.
We've talked about this in our own recruiting, how we ask about gender, how we ask about race. I mean, one of the things that used to be more prevalent was a single select on race, and now it's more likely to have either a multi-select type of question or a mixed race option or a prefer to self-describe open end on it. The way we often talk about it in our practice is like researching the research, like what is the best way to ask this question? You know, I think that probably comes up more for me because I'm a qualitative researcher and frequently what I'm doing is figuring out the best way to ask the question in the survey. but I think it's a question that comes up a lot about when someone, for instance, on a list of issues that are most important to you this election year, and you have words that contain a universe of meanings, you know, the economy, you know, immigration, whatever. These words are big words that might mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. I'm curious about how you think about the question type, the options available, how they're articulated, you know, how much does it matter, I guess, if the way you intend the word or the question is received that way by the respondent in the survey?
It's hugely important, I think. So for example, what's the most important? The economy, right? People may be choosing the economy because they think it's really good and they're jazzed about it, or they think it's really bad and they hate it, right? Sometimes researchers can avoid assuming that the respondent intended one thing or the other, you know, and try not to extrapolate beyond, you know, sort of what they actually said. But it's very easy to, when somebody says that, to sort of assume that the respondent shares, you know, the respondents who said the economy all sort of think it's because the economy's bad or whatever mm-hmm. the researcher's frame is, right? So I think you definitely need to be very careful about that kind of thing. When something like that, the thing to do is to follow up and ask, well, what specifically about the economy is it that you, mm-hmm. you know, are focused on? Things like that, to really kind of understand the nuances of what people think about a particular issue. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes the kind of big picture read is good enough, and you know, and sometimes it's not. And so these are all sort of research design challenges. You really do need to think through, like, specifically, what is the exact question? What is the thing you want to know the answer to? And then how do you best word it so that people don't get confused? You know, another problem I run into a lot, particularly with academic surveys, is they will ask about things where people have no idea what they're talking about, you know, mm-hmm. and so asking about very technical concepts or, you know, academic concepts from a discipline that maybe everybody who's a PhD psychologist knows about, right, but not necessarily the people taking your survey. One of the things I work really hard on is sort of trying to get into the mindset of, you know, your respondents. What is it reasonable to expect them to know about and care about? I sort of try to design surveys with that in mind. You know, especially with web surveys, people will give you an answer to the question.
Right.
And so it's very hard to know that that answer actually means anything, you know. Mm-hmm. One practice that is in a lot of surveys that I absolutely despise is not allowing people to skip questions. And when you do that, if you ask me a question that I have no answer to, that is completely not meaningful to me, I will click something just to get through. And you have data and it looks fine, but it doesn't actually reflect anything on my part. You just sort of put up an obstacle and I had to get past it. Those kinds of things are definitely important to think about and sort of design around when you're designing any kind of study.
So the other one I wanted to talk to you about, a slightly different topic, is this issue of mixed methods of sample collection and how that is impacting the quality of the data and some of the writing that your team has done about the problem of bogus responding in these online opt-in convenience samples. And I actually have a two-parter coming up with a guy called Rich Ratcliffe from Opinion Route, because this is his life's work, I think, is figuring out how fraud is working in convenience samples, which are primarily the source of sample for commercial research. There's a lot going on in that in terms of the incentives for fraudulent response and just the mechanisms for it. And there's a lot of things that are actually relatively easy to do to solve for it that not everybody's doing yet, and then harder problems to solve. But it's interesting to see, because not everybody is using probability panels and random sampling and use of offline methods for recruiting people into a panel, for example, based on nth selection of phone numbers or addresses or that sort of thing, that you do have a wide variance in kind of starting point of verification of who's in the sample, let's put it that way. And maybe you could just talk a bit about what you found with respect to kind of bogus responding. I think there were a couple of particularly interesting things that stood out, like age and ethnicity, but also a variety of other things.
People take shortcuts answering surveys all the time. This is something that happens in every survey. Mm-hmm. And nobody is sort of, you know, a perfect survey-taking robot, which is sort of how we would like them to be, but nobody is. In a lot of the online opt-in surveys, what we have found is there is a set of respondents who are sort of not in it to answer the questions in any sort of, you know, honest way. It's sort of trying to get through the survey as fast as they can, you know, with minimal effort, without being screened out in order to collect some sort of a reward, right? Mm-hmm. And so the motivation is not to answer accurately. It's just to sort of get through and collect your whatever it is you're being offered.
Right.
The big concern that people originally had about opt-in samples was the fact that they're not randomly sampled, and so they could be unrepresentative if they were overrepresenting certain kinds of people.
Mm.
And, you know, in this case, it's a different problem, which is there are certain kinds of people who are just not answering truthfully. And so what we've found that results in things like way overestimating rare characteristics in the population. So mm-hmm. we found people are way more likely to say that they received workers' compensation, which under 1% of adults actually receive workers' compensation in the U.S. It's very small, but huge percentage of opt-in respondents were saying yes to this question, that they received it. What we were seeing was that these kind of overestimates were dramatically larger in estimates for 18 to 29-year-olds, young adults, and estimates for Hispanic adults. And that, for example, the 65 or older age group, there's no difference between opt-in samples and probability-based panels. But this was a large difference that we were seeing across multiple opt-in samples, and specifically with those two demographic groups. And we don't actually have access to, like, what's the motivation. We definitely do not think it's that young people or Hispanics are somehow less good survey takers than other people. You know, what it is it's that the people who are not answering accurately are also being, you know, inaccurate about their age or their ethnicity, right? And some of that may be because those are sort of hard to survey groups, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you're somebody who's trying to game the system, claiming to be in that group is maybe makes you more likely to screen in and become eligible for more surveys or rewards.
Mm-hmm.
There are complicated ways in which the sort of ways these samples work. It could even happen if people are just answering randomly, but sort of the fact that there are so few honest members of those groups in online samples means mm-hmm. that sort of they fill up with these kind of bad actors. So it's hard to know exactly what's going on. It's probably a lot of different kinds of sort of misbehaviors. But yeah, what this leads to is that, right, for online opt-in samples, we're seeing, you know, really large errors that are concentrated in these groups, and they're not the kinds of things that you can sort of fix by waiting. You know, they're not overrepresenting certain kinds of people. There's just a lot of bad data. The problem also is that this problem is kind of tailor-made to produce alarming headlines about the youngest generation,
yes.
right? Because you're going to have, you know, 18 to 29-year-olds claiming something outlandish at high rates in an opt-in sample. One recent example that we wrote about was there was a headline finding that, you know, quarter of or 20% of 18 to 29-year-olds in the U.S. Thought the Holocaust was a myth. And it was on an online opt-in sample, and I thought that immediately thought, this is probably not the case. This is what I would expect to see if we have a bunch of bogus respondents in an opt-in poll saying they're 18 to 29 and choosing the answer that does not actually reflect the truth. And so we replicated this on our own panel, our probability-based panel, and found that this was not a real phenomenon. I saw another finding that was about, you know, Gen Zers taking their parents to interviews. And job interviews. And I'm pretty confident that that is, in fact, not a common thing that's happening. So this is something I worry about a lot. But it's sort of a kind of error that is just seems extra prone to producing some, you know, crazy findings people may want to run with because it's a good story. But it's really important to sort of, if you see these outlandish findings really on any poll, you know, take it with a grain of salt. if it strikes you as really surprising, you know, that should, set off your alarm bells. Yeah.
Yeah. There's another part of it that I think is interesting as well, which is especially if you think about these two demographic groups that are typically quite hard to sample. They're hard to get them to participate. Even if you can find them, they don't respond to you, that kind of thing. But the implications for it are quite interesting because, as you say, like it's good headline-y stuff to say. I think sometimes people are having a hard time pulling apart that the people who are saying they are 18 to 24 aren't. And so you can't say there's something wrong with 18 to 24 year olds. They all think that they're nuclear submarine, you know, drivers or whatever. Like,
right.
That example was so great. Obviously, a big part of this problem is the online opt-in sourcing of it, and that a lot of this is programmatic. And as I'll get into in the conversation with Rich, like, this is one of the big kind of drivers of this fraud is basically, as Rich would describe it, currency inequality, that like $2 to $5 isn't that big of a deal to an American, but it's a big deal to somebody in El Salvador or Bangladesh. And so, you know, the other thing is not everyone's particularly conscientious about programming their survey links. And so you can start getting people jumping to the end and just, you know, looking like they completed the survey, getting paid to have completed the survey, but they actually responded to no questions because they're doing link jumping. There's also people who open up developer panel and are able to see what screens you out and or what gets you a boost of incentive or that sort of thing. And so they select those things. The other part of it to me that just as I was reading that piece initially was that, you know, age is one of the first things that often get asked as part of a screen. And 18 to 24 is the first option, typically, in the battery. And so if you're just sort of speeding through, like, back to the top answer is the one I'm going to select. If I'm not intending to answer honestly anyway, pick 18 to 24, see what happens. Similar thing on the question about ethnicity now, we separate out Hispanic from race. And so, like, yes is the first choice on the Hispanic question, right? And so you just get these kind of weird distortions in what to make of these groups. And they tend to be groups that we're really obsessed with in an election year, because there's all these concerns about, like, so which way are Hispanics, as if they were a monolith, going to go? Are they more Republican leaning? Are they more Democratic leaning? What's going on with the youth vote? Like, all of those things become extremely important in the discourse. And so having unreliable, let's put it that way, data in there isn't very helpful.
Yeah, it's a challenge because, you know, if you look at other sources of data on those groups that aren't based on opt-in polls, there are some real things going on with young people and Hispanic Americans with respect to the election and partisanship and things like that. There is, you know, there is a story worth looking at there. This makes it kind of even, you know, more important to be careful about these kinds of things, right? You could really magnify certain findings that maybe overstate things. You know, it would be easy for sort of some high profile but erroneous polls to sort of produce a narrative about those groups in a way that is inaccurate. So, yeah, this is a concern that I have sort of going into this election. Is what's interestingly is that when we look at kind of the top line election vote numbers, the online opt-in samples really don't actually look different from the probability based samples. I think there are sort of certain kinds of questions, particularly for sort of rare things, rare characteristics, where this is a much larger issue. Whereas for something like the vote, where it's mostly around 50%, people sort of answering randomly kind of cancel each other out. Yeah. So there doesn't seem to be as much of an effect on the top line number that I've seen. Now we'll see what happens on election day. But yeah, when you start digging into crosstabs for some of these, there's the potential for some really misleading narratives to pop up as a result of this. Yeah. So this is something I'm going to be paying close attention to.
It's very interesting. I was just looking at a youth poll for Snapchat, and it was 18 to 29, and 50% of them owned their homes. That seemed unlikely to me.
That's a lot. that would be a lot.
The average age of first-time home buyership is like 31, 32, 33. So that would be weird for 50% of your 18 to 29 sample to already be homeowners.
But there are, you know, and there are people who collect good data on this kind of thing also, you know, so it's also cheaper to go look at. There's a wealth of government data on things like homeownership, actually, that's really high quality. So that's what you actually want to know about. Start there.
That was one of many things they were asking about in this poll. They were also asking political questions. But I think this maybe is a good way to transition to the last question I want to ask you, which is just there are a variety of things that are going on that make people freak out about polls. Often these things are rooted in some sort of misunderstanding about what polls are for, how they're designed, how they work. Sometimes it's in a kind of gap between what the pollster is trying to do and how their work gets reported. I'm curious what your, I don't know, pet peeves are about how polling gets talked about in the public discourse. Any myths you want to dispel, any bones you want to pick?
Well, I guess there's sort of two biggies. One that comes up is, although this is less of an issue now, I think people have figured this out, is telephone posters, dual pollsters do call cell phones. Who even answers their landlines? This was a frequent rebuttal to, you know, polls doing, mm-hmm. people doing RDD polls. And people have been calling cell phones for at least 10 years or longer. So that is not an issue. The other one is every year oversampling, or every election cycle, oversampling a group gets brought up where, you know, this pollster is oversampling young people or oversampling black adults in order to skew the results. And it's that this is another hobby horse of mine, which is they're not. When they do that, they're making sure they have a minimum number of those people in the sample so they can accurately represent them.
Yes.
But they get weighted down as a fraction of the whole population, you know, so they're not biasing the results. This is a thing that pollsters do to get, you know, high quality data, and mm-hmm. it is not affecting the results either way.
Yeah.
I guess the last thing I would say people should kind of look for transparency when they're looking at a poll. Mm-hmm. You know, I often get asked, how can you tell a good poll from a bad, or how can you tell if a poll is going to be accurate? And the reality is, a lot of the time you can't, you know. There's a lot of things for even the most rigorous pollsters that can happen that can lead to an inaccurate result. And so it's hard to know necessarily up front, you know, when those are happening. And they're not things we could necessarily see or know about. You know, it's much easier to say if a pollster does not provide a relatively comprehensive explanation of how they did what they did or why you should believe their results, that's a big red flag. You know, if all you hear is this was based on a representative sample of adults, That does not mean anything, right? And so, you know, really, I would say only look at and put much stock in pollsters who are willing to say how they did what they did, you know, show their work. There's a balance between excruciating detail that you don't need and sort of where to draw the line there. But if there's not any details about what they did, how they weighted, mm-hmm. how they drew the sample, where they drew the sample from, right? How people were contacted, then, you know, there's very little reason to believe that is an accurate result.
Yeah. And here I will just also commend, and I'll put it in the show notes as well, because there's a great one that I just saw today. Maybe it came out yesterday, which was the early look at Black voters' views on the election. And just to kind of point out, one of the things that makes Pew a great source for any kind of public research is there's always a how we did this section. There is always a methodology section. And so you can actually see how it was done and why it was done the way that it was done. And so even things like, I think I was looking through this earlier, and it included an oversample of non-Hispanic Black men, which is great because they are undersampled. And so, you know, if you want to do a deep dive into this group of people, then you need to have a large enough sample to read. And I think this is one of the things that, you know, I'll say in our practice, we've been doing more is oversampling of various groups so that there's a readable sample of them. You know, if you have a 1,000-person survey and only 120 of them are Black, that's not a lot you can say about that group with any confidence.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I could ask you 12,000 more questions because I am the person that wishes that people would just like overshare on the methodology section, but I know that's just me.
You would not believe how much effort goes into those little how we did this boxes and trying to make them as concise as is humanly possible. But yeah, no,
well,
thank you very
I'm
much.
Grateful.
This has been great. Thank you. Yeah, this has been a lot of fun.
Crosstabs is hosted by me, Farah Bostic, production by The Difference Engine, and edited by me. Music from Audio Jungle by S Audio. Find us at crosstabspodcast.com, where you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter and find out immediately when new episodes drop. Tell your friends about the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast service, drop us a note if you have any questions about poll design or sampling or weighting or anything else, and we'll see you next time.